small part of the population who voted unenthusiastically for them because they had nobody else to vote for. People begin to act, people begin to move, people begin to organize in the smallest of ways with the smallest of groups. Well, that's how social movements develop. And if everybody understands that the smallest action, it may not have any effect, but it might join to millions of other small actions, and at a certain point in history might bring about the kind of changes we want, might actually change policy, might actually boldly change policy, and do something about the horrors of racism and the unequal treatment of sexes and the unequal treatment of gay people and the unequal treatment of children, do something about all those things. Because we're approaching a new century. We don't want to go into this new century repeating the history of the old century. And I think it's possible not to repeat that and to do something new and startling. And not only that, whatever you accomplish, whatever is accomplished, and you never know what you will accomplish, and anybody would be rash, and I would be rash to predict, oh yes, it's certain, great things will happen. Except that I know that if you don't do anything, I know great things won't happen. If you act, great things might happen. But whether they do or not, in the process, in the course of it, by your action, by not simply living the life of a professional, but having another life, well, it will be more interesting and more fun and more rewarding. And as I say, whatever is accomplished, you will feel that you have participated in something worthwhile all the time. That's worth doing. Thank you for coming. Yes. Well, you represent a very strong point of view, which I hear from half of the people who talk to me about my book. That is, half of the people who talk to me about the People's History say, I feel depressed. And the other half say, well, I'm glad you told me about all the people who have fought back, about the movements and the struggles and people we never heard of, maybe it's not 50-50. I would like to think it's 50-50. Maybe it's 70-30, and I'm fooling myself about what I did. It's a tough balance to strike, that is, to be truthful about the terrible things that have happened and the number of times that strikers have been mowed down by the police and that strikes have been lost, to strike a balance between that and the magnificent resistance of people and people coming back and back and back. The IWW was destroyed by the government in the course of World War I, and their leaders were put on trial and they were given long sentences, and they took this magnificent organization and just eliminated it. And yet in its time, in its short life, it did remarkable and inspiring things. It fought for people's rights, it organized workers, it won the textile strike in Lowell in 1912 against the power of the textile companies. It defended the rights of free speech of IWW of speakers, labor organizers who went around in towns and were arrested, and then IWW people would gather from other states and they would come into those towns and they would speak and they would get arrested and they would do it again and again and again until the jails were full and overbursting and until they had to be released from jail. I mean, both things are true. That is, that we can read American history in such a way as to depress us and this is the complaint very often of various, and it's not the complaint of my friends and not your complaint, but very often the complaint of traditionalists who say, you know, you're telling bad things about the United States, and, you know, why don't you tell the good things? But I think it's a real challenge to be honest about the power of the establishment, but at the same time to tell those stories which have been left out of the history books. And how you look at an event can be looked upon in those two different ways. If you read the history of the civil rights movement, and you come to that part of the civil rights movement in which a part that's not as well known, let's say, as Selma, Alabama, or the Montgomery bus boycott, or the big marches in Birmingham. You come to the movement in Albany, Georgia, in 1961-62, the small town, almost a town that seemed like it was still in slavery, in cotton and peanut country in southwest Georgia. But in 1961, the black population of Albany, Georgia, rose up, as it hadn't done, and in anybody's memory, it rose up and rebelled against racial segregation in the city of Albany. And before you knew it, 700 people were in jail, 1,000 people were in jail, a good part of the black population of Albany, Georgia. And the history of that very often is written as the history is of one of the defeats of the civil rights movement, because when that movement stopped in Albany, Georgia, it seemed that nothing had changed. I never read it that way. And some of the people who participated in that movement didn't read it that way. And a black man named Charles Sherrod, who went down to Albany at that time, who worked with SNCC and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and who after everybody left, people who had gone down there to participate in the movement had left. He stayed, and has stayed there all through these years. And he writes about that time, and he says, I don't know why you call Albany, Georgia, defeat. Because after Albany, defeat or not, people were never the same. Black people were never the same. White people were never the same. And he pointed to all the ways in which Albany, Georgia, was different. And, you know how it is. You can look at the situation of racism in the United States today, and you can be in despair, and the people say, oh, the situation is worse than it ever was, things have gone backward, or the women's movement and sexual equality. And it's possible. There's enough evidence. This is a great thing about history, right? There's always enough evidence on all sides to paint whatever picture you want, you see. And then you can paint a picture which puts people in despair, or you can, without inventing anything, you can find those episodes and then those moments in history which suggest to you that something else is possible, even if that something else has not yet taken place on a big enough scale. You know, when I think of Albany, Georgia, I think of these hundreds and hundreds of black people lined up in front of the desk of the chief of police of Albany, Georgia, to be booked. You know, their names, addresses, and at one point the chief looks over the top of his desk and there's somebody there and he can just barely see the top of his head, and it was a 9-year-old kid being arrested, and the chief said, boy, what's your name? And the little boy replied, freedom. Those are the kinds of things that happen 1,000 times in different ways in every social movement in this country, that the spirit that people have and which, no matter what they do, cannot really be extinguished. I think it's possible to teach kids about people like that. I think it's possible to teach kids about other kids. I think it's possible to teach them about the kids who in the early part of 1903 traveled to Washington, D.C., kids who worked in the mines, were gathered up and organized by Mother Jones, who took them to Washington, D.C. to ask Congress to do something about child labor in the mines and elsewhere. And the kids marched around in front of the White House. Theodore Roosevelt was president. Sorry to mention his name. But the kids marched around carrying signs saying, we want time to play. I think there are lots of really wonderful and inspiring stories to tell kids about people who have fought back against terrible things in this country. Yes. Where do I get this? My optimism is not based on the certainty. I'm not arguing about what is certainly going to happen. I'm just arguing about what can happen if we act. You see, that's all I'm saying. And I don't think a succession of ruling classes in history establishes beyond any possibility of negation. I don't think an endless succession in history of ruling classes does away with the possibility that we can have a society without a ruling class. And just as I don't think that a history of repeated war and war and war means that we can't abolish war as a way of solving grievances in international affairs. Things do change. They obviously haven't changed enough. But I believe that what happened with the movement, the civil rights movement of the 60s, changed this country in a way where it can't go back beyond that. It can't go back to an older time. And I believe the women's movement changed consciousness about sexual equality in a very, very important way. And you know, even if these problems haven't been solved, and you say, well, we've had male domination all through history, but something has changed. And maybe we need to reconsider our sense of time. That is, maybe we've been too much in a hurry. Maybe we think that we need to do away with elite rule and with class rule and with sexual inequality and racism. We think we need to do it while we live. And maybe we ought to understand that maybe we can't do that, but we can move in that direction. And in the course of that moving in that direction, a lot of people will change, and change in very good ways, and a lot of good things will happen. But I think we have to have a much longer time perspective than a lot of people in social movements have had up to this point. Yes? Well, the early Indian societies of North America, they didn't have much to share, but what they had, they shared. And you read the reports of the Jesuit missionaries who came here and studied the way the indigenous people here lived and then wrote these reports. There's an amazing amount of documentation of much more closely examined than even modern anthropologists have done with societies. And there's a man named William Brandon who went through the archives in France to see what the Jesuits wrote back about. And you might think, well, he's romanticizing, and it's possible to romanticize ancient civilizations, and some of them were warlike and violent and so on. But also there were Indian societies in those times with a remarkable sharing of all the goods and with a remarkable equality between men and women. In fact, a matriarchal society in many of these instances, but a society in which the relations between men and women were better than the relations between men and women in modern times. I'm not pointing to these as things to which we must return, or saying things were ideal then. And I don't even think it's necessary to find, as some people think, you must find somewhere a place where the really good society existed, otherwise we won't believe one is possible. And I don't think it's necessary to do that. I think human beings are capable of creating things that were never created before. And I refuse to believe that only the things that have happened in the human past exhaust the possibilities for the human race. I don't think that's the case. Yes. What would I be saying about labor struggles in the 90s if we were writing at the end of the 90s? Or even writing now, I suppose. Well, she's talking about the fact that her sister is on strike with the strikers of the Detroit Free Press and wonders about the historical recognition of the labor struggles that are going on in the 90s, and she also asks about the future and what the election of Sweeney and head of the AFL-CIO means. I know the answers to all these questions. why do you think I was invited here? But we already have, right, in this part of the 90s that we've lived, we already have had many labor struggles that have gone on that were unreported in the press, and it could very easily be overlooked in history. I mean, they aren't like the great San Francisco strike of 34 or the sit-down strikes of 36, 37. But we always have labor struggles going on, which only the people involved in them seem to know about because the media simply don't report those things. And so most of the people in the country don't even know about the strike at the Detroit Free Press, just as most of the people don't know about the long strike that's been going on in Decatur, Illinois, which a very bitter strike. Most people don't know that a few years ago there was a strike of restaurant workers in Minneapolis, and hotel and restaurant workers union, and the hotel and restaurant workers went on strike against this hotel in Minneapolis, and they were out on the picket line in the winter months, and out, and it didn't seem they were going to win. Then they decided to have a session in which they felt they had to do something more. They called in somebody who had been very active in the anti-war movement days in Minneapolis and been active since then, who had engaged in and organized many acts of civil disobedience. They decided they had to move on to civil disobedience. And so he came, this mysterious stranger, came and talked to them about civil disobedience and nonviolent action. And after that, they organized themselves. They went into the lobby of the hotel. They occupied it. They sat down. They refused to move. And they won their strike. And the point is, who ever heard of it? So in order for the history of the labor struggle in the 90s to be recorded, we have a big job to do. People have to notice what is going on in their locality and spread the word to other localities. And we all have to become, in a way, historians. We all have to become communicators. We have to make up for what the mass media don't do in order to spread the word, in order to encourage people about the fact that people in other parts of the country are doing things. I discovered during the Gulf War, as I went around the country speaking about the Gulf War, that anti-war activities, and remember, the press was reporting 85-90% of the population supported the Gulf War, and I didn't doubt that it was true in a very superficial way, in the way you get quick responses from people who, when you put a microphone in front of them, are you for the war? Are you for the troops? Are you for the president? But at the same time, when I went around the country, I found a remarkable opposition to the war Texas City, Texas. Here are 400 people gathered in a room in Texas City, Texas, and we talk about the war, and it seems that everybody in that room is against the war. Who heard about it anywhere else in the country? Or I was in Mankato, Minnesota last week, and they were telling me about something I had never heard of. And among all the things, and I'm presumably a historian of the anti-war movement, what it means I've written about the anti-war movement. But they told me about something I never heard of, and that is in Mankato, Minnesota. There was a march against the war, a blocking of the streets. The police force came out and stayed in the side streets and wouldn't come to the blockers and the demonstrators. And when a truck driver decided he was going to ram his truck through the people sitting on the street, and he started up his engine, the police surrounded him and took him out of the truck and took him away, and the demonstration went on. But the things like that, you know, I discovered when I was in Olympia, Washington, that during the Gulf War, that thousands of people in Olympia, Washington, had marched on the state legislature and occupied the state legislature. It was not reported anywhere else in the country. And I guess you know what I'm saying about whatever the labor movement does do, it is important that word get out about what is done. We need to wrap up. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. I see. Okay, we'll take one more. Okay. It's called civil disobedience. Yes. Or do I charge? Okay. I'm like the doctor that my family used to go to, who would charge people who had money more and people who didn't have money less. So I go to places where I don't get anything. But I shouldn't say that. Don't spread that word around. Thank you for coming.
You were just listening to Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States, part two of a special two-part program. He spoke at Reed College in Portland, Oregon. Howard Zinn, Professor Emeritus at Boston University, was perhaps this country's premier radical historian. He's the author of A People's History of the United States and You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. Howard Zinn passed away in 2010. His work continues to inform and inspire. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent, progressive nonprofit in our 37th year. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We have a series of programs featuring Howard Zinn. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To order copies of today's program, Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States, Parts 1 and 2, and for his classic books, A People's History of the United States, and You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, that's alternativeradio.org. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with a special composition, a remix by Joel Tarman, performed by the Kronos Quartet on the occasion of the Zinn Centenary.
The government are not given to self-reflection or to self-criticism. No, if you criticize the United States government, you're met with the exhortation, well, why don't you go somewhere else? Well, sometimes they say, why don't you go back to where you came from, you know, which might be Brooklyn. Well, this notion of superiority and exceptionalism starts early. Well, here in
Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630. The colony had just begun, and the governor, Winthrop, talked about the Massachusetts Bay Colony as a city on a hill. I think Reagan embellished it a little and talked about a golden city on a hill. Well, the idea of a city on a hill, you've probably heard that expression a number of times, the idea of a city on a hill is a nice one, because it suggests a model. It suggests setting an example. I mean, that is a wonderful thing to be. But it doesn't stop there with just being a city on a hill. After Governor Winthrop utters these words about being a city on a hill, just a few years later, the people in the city on a hill move out to massacre the Pequot Indians. Between what the government does and what God approves of. That process of not being just a city on a hill, but of moving out, of expanding, that's a persistent fact of American history, going all the way back to those first settlers and coming down to the present day.
Community who will support you on your academic journey, the Student Learning Commons has got your back. The Student Learning Commons is SFU's Academic Success Center. We provide free workshops, one-on-one consultations, coaching, and online tutoring with a focus on writing, study skills, and academic English. All Student Learning Commons programs and services are available to SFU students and are approved by SFU as providing ethical, academically honest support. Learn more by visiting our locations in the library on all three SFU campuses, or check us out online at learningcommons.sfu.ca.